Being that close to the performance data and having the content production in-house just really allows us to understand the customer better and to really work on and continuously improve our brand. It pushes us to catch friction points or fall-off questions that people have about our products and figure out how to respond to them, which we really wouldn't be doing if I just delegated it to an agency.
It's the E-commerce Masterplan Podcast, here to help you solve your marketing problems and grow your e-commerce business. Cutting through the hype to bring you inspiration and advice from the e-commerce sector and beyond. Here's your host, Chloe Thomas.
Hello and welcome. It's great to have you here. Thank you for hitting play and choosing to listen to one of our inspiring guests. Huge thank you to Siri from DEMA, D-E-M-A, for introducing us to this brilliant guest. Thank you so much, Siri. Really appreciate the intro. In this episode, we're talking to a fashion business who are over 10 million euros about how they are keeping their head office team down to just 8 people. Yes, there will be talk about AI. Yes, there will be talk about prioritization, and we'll be getting into some stuff around Meta ads too. Please listen to the end of this episode so you don't miss out on my guest's top tips and my own take on this episode. And now to introduce our special guest. Douglas Holm is the head of online at Merquest, sellers and designers of quality classic men's shoes. Founded in 2016, they now sell via their Shopify store and 4 stores in Sweden, Norway, New York and London, plus a select group of partner stores. Turnover is now at 10 million euros a year. Hello, Douglas.
Hey, how are you, Chloe?
I'm good. It's great to have you here. We don't often get a Swedish business on the show, so it's very cool to get to find out a bit about what's going on with you all in Sweden. But before we get into all of that, how did you get started in the world of e-commerce?
I mean, that's a great question. One that I've always, people usually ask, and I haven't really put together the best answer to. But to make a long story short, my journey in e-commerce started way back in 2016. When an acquaintance of mine made a killing selling stickers on Shopify, and I thought, well, if he could do it, why can't I do it? And that's kind of where it started. And then it grew into at first an obsession and then a passion. And now I've worked with it for 10 years. It's basically all I do. I live and breathe e-commerce.
So what, other than shoes, what products have you sold over the years?
So, I mean, back in those days, we tested everything from jewelry to watches to whatever we could come up with that we thought the algorithm would like. But then as I transitioned into a serious role at an actual company, at first I sold supplements at a supplement chain. So I handled their B2C at first, and then I took over the whole B2C, B2B operation, the e-commerce there, and ran both. And then I transitioned over to Myrkvist 5 years ago now, and I've been here ever since, growing along with the company.
I was thinking, should I ask you, do you prefer shoes or supplements? But that's a loaded question, isn't it? And your boss might listen to this, so let's not ask you that question.
I can go ahead and answer it. I much prefer shoes. Ever since I was a child, I've always been very, very style interested. So it's just a perfect fit.
Excellent. So you're, when the sample sale happens, you're first in the line.
Yeah, I prefer, it's a huge perk having that early access to upcoming releases.
Definitely. That is one thing I definitely miss about not being client side anymore, is the ability to get your hands on the product at that point. But this isn't about my or your shopping habits. So Douglas, tell us a bit more about Merquest. Where in the world are you based and where are you selling to?
Another great question. So we're based out of Stockholm. We're founded here right in the city. Have been located here since the beginning. Then we, of course, have our 4 stores across the world, but we sell essentially to every market where we have demand. So we're very international and very horizontal in our mindset there. We're really trying to find early adopters across the board instead of drilling down and really starting to figure out how to gain major market share in any specific market.
I suppose that's one of the challenges when you're coming out of a country the size of Sweden, is there's only so big you can grow within that country before you have to start looking overseas. So how early on did the business go international? Was it a day one strategy or a realization a couple of years in?
So the realization, I mean, it was always there. We were always open for international business, but we really pivoted after I joined the company and we did a deep dive and just saw that the data pointed us to the fact that we could get customers both overseas, of course, in the US and Australia and wherever, but also in other European countries for a lot less money than we could in Sweden, because those early adopters in the shoe business, at least back then, were a lot easier to get to than the mass market appeal for shoes of our kind.
But you, so it's partly a cost of acquisition decision of comparing these countries and going, actually, there's where the lovely green pasture is. Let's go over there.
Yeah, essentially. Back then, I think we used to call it horizontal scaling. So just always trying to be where the customer is. And in our case, that was like finding the right niche groups in the right countries instead of just trying to build, massively invest in building up like that mass market appeal that we're now starting to achieve in Sweden.
So I described in the intro that the product is shoes, but you've expanded into a couple of other product range that are kind of shoes adjacent as well. So can you explain much better than I would a little bit about the product range?
Yeah. So, I mean, the founding idea was premium footwear without a premium price tag. So we wanted to come out and fight the big British brands, essentially sell shoes that are very close in quality but cost a third of the price. And that, of course, meant we came up with the most classic shoe styles possible, a penny loafer, an Oxford, and so forth. But over time, we've kind of matured into a really broad array of shoes. So now we offer everything from black pattern shoes for nights at the opera to very contemporary sneakers that are fit for essentially any occasion.
And then you've also then got the socks and accessories and other bits and pieces too.
Yeah, of course. And then we have our best-selling socks. For us, that's a given cross-selling product. And then, of course, we have the shoe trees that were like the first thing we actually sold. And then that grew into the company we are today.
Wow, very cool. And what does the team look like at Merquist?
So at the head office, we're 8 people now. In the e-commerce team, it's myself, and then we have one full-time support customer experience employee, and I'd say half a person that does logistics and customs, because he also works in the supply chain team. And then we have one person running supply chain, and one person doing a joint retail and product development department, running that. And then we have one person that does brand marketing, and then of course our CEO. So it's a very lean team.
It's crazy lean. So that's in-house, in head office, everything, including customer service, but not including manufacturing or fulfillment. Would that be a fair way of simplifying it?
Yeah, essentially. We of course have partner factories where we work with instead of our own in-house at this stage. And then we do have a 3PL, but yeah, other than that, we're pretty much in-house.
And on your within your micro e-commerce team and marketing team, are you doing everything or using agencies for Facebook ads, Google ads, email, or is that all being done across all those countries by the head office team?
So I handle everything except Google Ads, which we have outsourced because I just couldn't be asked. There's too much optimization and too little time in the day. And that's the least fun ad platform, the least creative one. Mm-hmm. So we kind of we just offloaded that, at least for now. And that's working out fine for us because we really appreciate having Meta Ads in-house and being that close to the data and seeing how our customers react to different kinds of creatives and on like our brand at large.
And it's kind of mind-blowing that you're running a business of that's doing 10 million euros on 8 people in head office, including the customer service and all the logistics and all the customs and all the rest of it. But then you're also running substantial business across multiple different territories with that tiny team. How do you, I mean, is that like a central goal of the business to keep the team small? And if so, how do you achieve it?
I mean, a great question. And yes, it is for us, it's like the North Star operationally for us as to, I mean, at the beginning of the year, we kind of landed in the fact that I think we can probably at least double, if not more, without adding any headcount. at this stage, because we've always been laser focused on optimizing processes and removing friction, which has been, of course, hard historically. But now with everything that AI is enabling, we've just been able to automate and fix so many things in our business that have been blockers before.
It's like a laser sharp focus on how do we systematize this? How do we systematize this? Which might mean AI, might mean automation, might mean simplification, but it's that reduce the amount of time someone has to spend on it, basically.
Yeah, the essential idea is that no one wants to do busy work, or at least they shouldn't want to. And by fixing that, we can instead let the people that work here actually spend their time on things that provide value and is fun to do. Instead of spending time reading invoices manually, we can just scan them and like have the system take over, things like that. And then the same thing with customer support. I mean, that's for us the most obvious touch point where customer facing AI has been the first area we deployed it in, since we could very easily at least automate the low-hanging fruit questions about, oh, how does this shoe work with these pants? Okay, a human doesn't actually have to respond to that. And the customer, of course, they value the human touch there, but what they're really seeking is reassurance. And if an automated reply within 1 minute of their email can achieve that, then it's a net positive.
Not just the customer service questions around where's my parcel, which is often where people start with automation and chatbots, but the will this look good on me, which I think people would assume is a more difficult thing to automate, but presumably not.
Yeah, and I mean, it is, and it was, and that's kind of, so this whole automating communication thing in conjunction with us rolling out on-site AI search as a pilot project about a year ago, kind of kicked off our first real, or gave us like the first nugget of information we needed to really start on this journey. Because when the on-site search didn't function as well as we thought it would, it became really apparent that, okay, the issue is that our input data, so the product descriptions, the actual information we have on the website about everything doesn't cover enough subjects, and it isn't structured in a way that allows LLMs to break it down and understand what this shoe really is and what it's for and what it would work with. So we're working really hard on building that out. Because, I mean, sure, it's easy and it's sexy to talk about it in the LLM sense. But just like good SEO used to be or still is, it's just good customer experience. I mean, your site loading fast, navigation functioning and everything like that. Optimizing for LLM is essentially just optimizing for the customer journey anyway. So it's like a win-win.
I had a feeling we were going to get onto the data underlying the AI, because I was assuming you'd spent a lot of time on it. So I'm glad you brought it up. And it does strike me as if you go through the effort of getting all that much that data right, the obvious things, first things to do with it are site search and support chatbot. You know, because they've suddenly got everything they need to deliver for the customer. So why wouldn't you do them? So you started with those. Where did you go next?
I mean, the next and the ultra long term scope and vision is, of course, offsite. So how do we place in ChatGPT, in Claude, or in Gemini, or whichever model people use to search? How does Google rank our content? That's the long-term goal, but it's a lot harder to optimize when you can't really measure the outcome in a reliable way. So we're just trying to do both at the same time, because they both feed into the same core concept, essentially.
It does strike me that if you're getting that, especially the product information, right, by which I don't just mean the sizes, I mean the richer product data as well, then it's supporting your use of AI as a customer service tool, be that search, be that bots, be that emails, whatever it might be. It's also supporting your ranking in AI search, and it's supporting your SEO as well, and it's supporting greater customer experience if it's customer facing data. So it's kind of just such an obvious thing to improve, because it's you can't categorically measure the improvement it's having on the AI search at the moment, but it's improving so many different areas of the business all at the same time through one project.
Yeah, exactly. And like in a business like ours, where our whole core business idea is going up against like 100-year-old heritage giants, in the men's shoewear game, being able to be this fast and move this fast in these questions really gives us an edge, because we know that our competitors aren't doing this, which means that the field is wide open. So any improvement we make is going to be a huge leap, and like a major leap is going to be a moon landing essentially for us. And that's kind of what makes it so exciting. But and then, of course, the hard part there is, okay, how do you actually understand what the user is asking? Because if you really zoom out and look at it, what your LLM placement is essentially based on what the AI thinks the prompter wants to see, right? And to get there, our content has to be able to kind of answer those questions and bring a bit of an authority. So we're working with one partner there. They work really hard with like off-site measuring what kind of conversations are going on about our products. Okay, how, if people are looking for black penny loafers, which questions are they asking? What are people saying on Reddit? Where are the gaps between the data we have and what people want to know? And then that, of course, instantly feeds into just an improved on-site experience.
As you talk about it, it helps me remember that we are now becoming quite evolved in how we approach these things. You know, there's a research process that's pretty standard. There's a where we put it and how we handle it that's now become pretty standard. Have you seen, I know you know it's hard to track, but have you seen this starting to pay off in terms of traffic and sales already?
Yeah, I mean, so as you say, it's super hard to measure because we only get a fraction of the data. The referral pointers and UTM tags are usually stripped from LLM traffic, but we can still see like the small fraction we can see. We see a 400% increase year over year. And that is, of course, both combined, like overall LLM usage going up. But the graph correlates very well to when we started really doing, making big leaps here on the content side.
Because whilst the traffic may be, you know, the usage of LLMs is going up by the consumer, at the same time, what's also going up is the sophistication of the LLM model. And as we, if we assume it follows the path that Google took, it's going to become harder to rank well as it becomes more sophisticated. And then you've also got more people waking up to the fact they've got to give a damn. So it's, I think if you can track the same growth as LLM usage at the moment, you're probably ahead of the curve. I would have thought, based on a finger in the air. Rather than precise data, but I think...
Yeah, I mean, and it's super hard. And I mean, we're starting to get anecdotal evidence. Like, someone came up to me at a convention and said, oh, I heard about your brand when it started, and then I found you guys on ChatGPT while looking for a suede spray. So I went to the store and I bought a spray, which was a lot of fun. She had no idea that we... And it was a woman as well, which makes it even more interesting. She had no idea we have, like, we're doing so much work on this side of things. And we somehow managed to place really well for something as generic as a suede spray, which is super fun to see.
And changing tack slightly, but going back to the lean team idea and how AI fits into that, how are you deciding which part of the business to test AI on next or to automate next? I mean, I would assume you must have endless time sheeting going on, or, you know, like a whiteboard where you write down something that's annoying you day to day. I mean, there's lots of theories for how you go about working out what's the next thing you should automate, reduce the human time in, et cetera, et cetera. But how do you go about doing it? Is there a big strategy, or is it more of a vision and everybody does it their own way?
So, I mean, that's a great question, and I don't really have an answer quite yet because we started really digging into this 6 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. But in that time, we've kind of completely reworked how we do customs, how we do stuff like that. So, of course, we had a couple of low-hanging fruit things we could attach, but now we're looking at, okay, how do we continue this work? How do we do this over a longer time span? How do we really prioritize? The model we're trying internally now is that I started playing around, and then I had that moment where it just clicked and I understood, okay, this is probably what's possible. And then I've continued to drill down. And now I'm trying to help my colleagues to have the same kind of epiphany. On the product side, we're now super AI heavy in the like ideation phase where we're trying to figure out the design.
Wow.
To view different material options, because in physical, selling physical goods, sampling takes a lot of time, right? Because you have to have it made and then shipped, and then you have to have another round. Now we can, instead of going from a sketch to like a a sample guess from the factory, we can send the final design to the factory right away in less than a week of coming up with the concept. So it's really fast tracking that side of the business as well.
Wouldn't have assumed it would work, it would help in that space, but I can totally see how it would. And I love how you're saying about how you are, you're kind of like the person on the front foot with AI, and then it's key for the business to have you upskilling everybody around you as you make those decisions, you know, so they can then see how it can apply in their areas. Personally, I find it difficult to work out which bit next to do, because I can see like there's a huge opportunity there. That bit's difficult, but I could think that would be really hard to automate to AI to improve. And then we've already bought this tool, which could solve that problem, but that's a tiny problem, but we've already got the tech to do it. Or I saw a great webinar yesterday that showed me this and I got really excited about it. How do you, because like you said, there were some really obvious quick wins, but you can tend to get past those quite quickly. And then it's very easy to get distracted and spend a lot of time optimizing something, which there was no benefit in optimizing at all. So have you got any tips on how to navigate that mindset? I don't think there's a perfect way to do it, but anything you found that's helpful that works?
So for me personally, in my very broad role, the way I scan the field right now is I always try to look at cost savings. Like that's the easiest, the lowest hanging fruit, right? And that's why we're now not using any external development consultants anymore. I'm just vibe coding everything on a website, which is, I mean, it has improved the output quality and the speed at least 10x from what we used to have with our offshore consultants. That was like an obvious first win. And now we're just looking at, okay, how many hours does this take? Versus how easy it is to automate. I mean, it's I don't have a more sophisticated approach than that right now.
I don't know that it necessarily needs to be that more sophisticated. If you're talking about money and time, those are the two biggest costs for any business. So if you're tracking those, then you're presumably pretty well ahead of things. Now, you also mentioned, Douglas, it's all right to pick your brains on this, that you're running all the Facebook ads in-house.
Yes.
Which I know a lot of businesses are on the fence about at the moment. Where do you put the creative production? Where do you put the management of the actual ad account? In-house, out-house, work it all out. You know, there's lots of different opinions. So tell us about your rationale for keeping it in-house and how you're making that really deliver for you, especially given you're running this internationally as well.
Yeah. And I mean, for us, it all began with cost, like everything else. But over time, quite early, we realized that after taking it in-house, being that close to the performance data and having the content production in-house just really allows us to understand the customer better and to really work on and continuously improve our brand. It pushes us to catch friction points or fall-off questions that people have about our products and figure out how to respond to them, which we really wouldn't be doing if I just delegated it to an agency. And due to being in-house, we're now also looking at, like everyone else, okay, how can we need to 10x our content production. How can we do that without breaking the bank? So it's a huge challenge for us, but it's a lot of fun as well.
Yes, there's the cost saving, but there's also that all the nuances of the customer behavior that you're able to feed back into the wider business. I'm guessing with the way you talk about it, it's not being outsourced anytime soon, is it? There's too much value coming out of it.
Exactly. For us, it's key, essentially, since we're so online heavy. Being close to the way the brand is perceived has been key for our continued growth at the rate we're growing.
E-commerce Master Plan is supported by some of the greatest companies in the e-commerce sector. Here's a reminder of who they are. It's time for the top tips round.
Okay, I love this section because it gives me and our listeners some really quick ideas for taking our businesses to the next level. Douglas, are you ready for the top tips?
Yes.
Okay, the book top tip. If everyone listening to this podcast agreed to take Friday off and read a book to make their business better, which book would you recommend?
That is such a great question. I mean, sadly, the way my schedule looks these days, I don't really read the any relevant business books anymore. But the thing I find that works the best for me, and especially actually if it is on a Friday, is just leaving work with that one issue you can't solve on your mind, and then letting it brew at the back of your mind overnight. Maybe you cook some nice dinner, maybe have a glass of wine and put on some nice music and just lean back into the weekend. And then usually that brings me that epiphany that I need to take things to the next level.
Oh yeah, letting the subconscious work it out for you whilst you do something else. Awesome tip. Definitely. I totally agree with you on that one. The traffic top tip: which marketing method do you either prize over all others or think doesn't get the press it deserves?
I mean, that's a great question. And this is going to be like an omni-channel brick and mortar plus online specific tip. But a lot of people are probably under investing in their retail space if they have it. And like by now we have really good data on this, but the value of a storefront and that storefront window for our online sales over time is just immense. Like our physical presence feeds into our online presence, which then brings back people back into the brick and mortar. So really looking into and seeing if you can find those patterns, and then trying to up the game in the way you function in the physical world has been just a huge step for us. I mean, that's what we have. Three huge screens on the second floor of our New York store blasting out brand content every day. Even though it costs a lot of money, for us, it's just been driving crazy growth in the surrounding area.
I love that, because so often people do neglect that physical store and just see allocate the costs in arguably the wrong places. So I think that's such a good one. And anyone who wants to see what Marquist's stores look like, there's some great photography of them on the website. Having had a look at it earlier today, I am not surprised Douglas mentioned that as being a key traffic driver. Tool top tip: maybe a collaboration tool, a social media plugin, a phone app, or just a way of working. Is there a cool little tool you use that makes you and your team more efficient from day to day? Now, Douglas, I'm expecting something impressive here after all we've said already today.
Yeah, so I'm going to hit everyone with a 2026 cliche. But like my number one tip, especially if you're finding it hard to get started with the whole AI and the AI vibe coding and everything like that internally, is just to find one small task that you do repeatedly, that you spend time on, and then just try to make an app for it in Lovable. It's not going to work the first time. I had to do 3-4 iterations. But just finding that one thing, one simple little process to try and automate and work on in your free time. Because once it works, you're going to have that moment where it clicks. And it's going to feel like you just won the World Cup, essentially.
I think a lot of people are falling into the trap of approaching AI as though they're about to create Michelangelo's David on their first attempt. And it's like, no, you need to start off with plasticine. That's how you, if you want to create Michelangelo's David, you need to start off sculpting with plasticine for a bit. And it's like, so I love your tip, because it's like, pick one small, simple thing, learn the basics, and then you can start working up to your Michelangelo's David at the end of the complex project.
And it could be as easy as just, okay, I have to read this CSV file and translate it to this other format. And I mean, just figuring out how to do that, even like inside of Claude or ChatGPT or whatever, is a great first step. Because you need to play around with it, right? To really be able to dig your claws into it.
Definitely. Okay, the carbon top tip: what's your favorite way to reduce the carbon footprint of an e-commerce store?
And I mean, here again, this is coming from both a carbon footprint and a commercial standpoint, because I do really care about both. I mean, I shop a lot of secondhand. This suit is secondhand. But for us, like the biggest contributor to our carbon footprint that is completely unnecessary, because we have a very slim supply chain, but is grading issues with our shoes. So unnecessary returns is one of the best things to work through. Both because it's going to save you a lot of money in locked up stock and logistics costs back and forth, but it's also going to save a lot of emissions that are completely unnecessary, because I mean, no one buys because they want the return, right? Some people do, but you can't get rid of those. But most people don't want the wrong size. So ensuring that your size guide is right, or that you have accurate pictures on your website, whatever it may be, to try and reduce that return rate is really key, the way I see it.
The whole piece of helping the customer buy the right product in the first place, so that it doesn't have to be a second journey of the parcel. basically.
Exactly. And it's good for everyone. The customer has a better experience, there's less emissions, and you have a better profitability at the on the order level.
I'm sure it's the case you get a better customer lifetime value if the customer's not having to go through the hassle of a return as well. So awesome tip. Always love it when someone brings up returns at this point in the show. Douglas, before we say goodbye, could you please let the listeners know where they can find you and your business on the web and social media?
Yeah, I mean, this is the part I've been scared of. With a name as Swedish as this, I'm going to have to try and figure out how to say the domain, but it's Myrqvist, so it's MYRQVIST.com. Hopefully that's you're able to parse that.
We will add links to that, obviously, in the show notes. And wherever you're watching it, you can see it spelt because it will be in the name of the episode. So Myrqvist, that's fine. Myrqvist.com to go and find out all about it. And I believe, Douglas, you've got a special deal for the audience if they want to check out your shoes.
Yeah. If you're interested in checking out what we do for our listeners, use code MASTERPLAN for 10% off our shoes, socks, belts, shoe care. Whatever you may need, both online and in our stores. Just stop by and have a chat, if nothing else.
Brilliant. Douglas, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been fascinating chatting with you and learning how you're approaching keeping your business so lean and your marketing and everything else. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Fascinating to hear how Myrqvist have set themselves the goal of remaining a head office team of just 8 as they double to 10 million euro turnover over the next few years. I think they might just make it. It seems like they're doing all the right things. And really interesting to hear how they're approaching using AI to help them achieve that goal, but also the approach to the Meta ads and deciding initially to keep those in-house because of the cost saving, but then also the alignment with the creative team who are in-house, which gives them the flexibility to double down on what's working, but also gives them all that more nuanced data coming back out of it that they can feed into making the business better. Thoroughly enjoyed our chat with Douglas. I hope you did too. You can get your hands on our notes from this episode, including the top tips and links we mentioned, by heading over to ecommercemasterplan.com. You can also use our direct episode short link. That's ecmp.info/the number of this episode to get to the right page of the website. When you get there, why not add yourself to our newsletter list as well? If you like this episode, then make sure you check out episode 367, where I'm chatting with Ash Hubbard from Grenson Shoes, which really builds on this episode. And if you want more on fashion, then head to ecmp.info/fashion for all the fashion episodes on the website. Thank you for tuning into this and every episode of the E-commerce Masterplan podcast. We bring you a new interview every week because we want to inspire and help e-commerce business owners like you to succeed and thrive with your business, including encouraging businesses and consumers to make more sustainable buying decisions. So if you know someone this show can help, please tell them to listen to the E-commerce Masterplan podcast. Have a great week, and don't forget to keep optimizing.
Thank you for listening to the E-commerce Masterplan podcast. Find out more at ecommercemasterplan.com/podcast.